talking about the meeting in April 72 in David King's office and the roundhouse in Santa Fe and various state officials there. And King opened the meeting. He didn't even give Jerry Anderson and Molly Phillips a chance to say anything. He just sort of said how it was going to be, figured they understood our requirements and knew where to go. They were being heavily influenced by a lot of their ranching buddies, or a lot of their support was. The trouble is, nobody in New Mexico knew what the hell we were trying to do. And Anderson and Phillips both just caved in. For me, after all that tough talk at breakfast, and I don't get mad easily, but I got mad. Part of it was anger at these two guys from NSF. They were going to blow this whole thing. And I could tell by Vic's face, he felt the same way I did. At that point, I just sort of took over and I said, look, if it's, we know where it needs to be. We've studied it hard. And if it doesn't, if it's not going to go there, it's not going to be built in New Mexico. I went way out on a limb with that. Mm-hmm. But he didn't know I was out on a limb. Mm-hmm. And he was sort of taken aback. And it was at this point that this man, I think he might have been the Fish and Game Commissioner, who I'm sure ran on high octane a good part of the time, came in and he actually backed me up. And turned out to be a friend through the rest of the meeting. He had to be careful how he did it. He was vulnerable. But he, I don't remember the man's name. I'm not even sure I'm remembering the correct person here, but it was a very tense time, and it was obvious that things could get pretty well ruined if we didn't handle it right. And I guess took more on myself than technically I was supposed to, but there's no one else to do it. Vic represented AUI. He could not represent the science. Mm-hmm. It had to be me, and I did it. I was so angry. Finally, this meeting settled over. We left. I could not bring myself to speak to Anderson and Phillips. Basically, just walked off. And I think we returned to Charlottesville. I saw Dave Heeshan, and then Vic and I turned around, if I've got this the right way, and it might be backwards, and said, now we've got to go talk to the ranchers. And it was, I was so furious. I told Dave the whole story. He backed me on what I'd done, which he really had no choice, because I'd already made the marks on the wall, you know. But still, he backed me fully. He listened carefully. He paid me the respect of believing me. I don't know what happened after that, but it was noticed that Maury Phillips and Jerry Anderson were no longer involved with anything related to VLA from the NSF. But he's got my so-and-sos, who were great at talking tough when it was safe to do so, to do anything when they they should have behaved differently. Well, Vic and I think I have it in the right order, but I'm not certain, came back within a matter of days, came here. People, the person whom we were going to hit the hardest with this was Jack Pruden. Jack, like a lot of the ranchers around here, totally distrusted the federal government with damn good reason. Jack Bruton, his family was thrown off their ranch down here on the White Sands. Temporarily, you know, until the war is over, faithful promises this will all be returned to you as soon as the war is won. They don't have it yet. What sort of credibility does the government get out of this? And with my background, I was totally sympathetic to them myself, but I had to talk like I was presenting something they didn't like. Well, I was, but I also believed in it. There was a meeting of Jack Bruton's father-in-law, Mike Harriet. Does that name mean anything to you? Okay, he was the father of Jack's wife, father of Bob. I'm horrible with names, too. I know perfectly well. Anyway, he was a programmer at Left and REO at the same time. Bob. I always called him Bob. I never used his last name. Bob Duquette. Bob Duquette. He's a Canadian, basically a mathematician. Worked as a programmer for us. So Mike was a French Basque who had come over at the time of the First World War and done very well in sheep farming, sheep ranching. He was one of the founders of the First State Bank, etc. And a hard-nosed character. He died, I suppose, 20 years ago now. Maybe more than that. But anyhow, he was Jack Bruton's father-in-law. And you must at least know of Jack Bruton. And, well, they arranged that we could meet them at Mike's house down here. And I walked in. And that was a tense time. These guys saw us as government people. I had to explain that we didn't work for the government. We worked for an outfit that was funded by the government. And gave them a whole background as we understood it. And I knew better than to tell anything but the purest truth that I could come with. Because those guys will see through you. If I'd come from New York, I wouldn't have thought they were smart. I knew better because of my background. And was grilled. Sitting there was Marvin Ake. You heard of Marvin Ake? Marvin Ake was a rough guy, extremely intelligent. He had two houses. One of them was full of books and one he lived in. And, but he was rough. And, he may have killed somebody once, on a matter of principle. You don't get the straight story on that, but I suspect that things happen that are not accurately remembered or talked about. And he was looking at me with daggers, because I was doing the talking. Again, Vic was there to back me up on the organizational things. And it was very tense. And then, all right, do you know Sissy Bruton? She worked at NREO. She's teaching school in Magdalena now. She was the new bride, had just married Jackie Bruton, who's Jack's son. Mm-hmm. They all live up there at the Bruton headquarters south of the VLA. And she was sitting there, and she's a bright-eyed young thing, you know, probably 21 or 22 at the time. And there's all this pretty tense talk going on, and then Sissy pipes up and says, "Are there going to be jobs for secretaries?" And that totally broke the ice. She said it in such an innocent way, and I think she's genuinely like that. And we all, everyone, just sat there and laughed. It broke the ice considerably. But it's one of these precious moments that one remembers. This young lady who didn't have any idea what was going on, really, but she comes out with a very practical question. And then the laughter that came, it came from the heart in all of us. And things got better. And Jack and I had tense times. He is now, I'm proud to say, one of my best friends. I immensely like him, and I think he can stand me for once. But the thing here, that was such a dicey time. I went around and talked to some other people who would have been more tangentially affected. There was the oil man from Texas. That was another trip. Should I talk about any more of these people or not? Okay. Yeah, this is... I forget his name. He's a big Presbyterian and a complete pirate. He was an oil man. Lived in Amarillo. The HBRH ranch on the north side of US 60 up there was his. He told me very proudly that he bought that during the Depression for about $3,000. That's a unit that at that time probably had a market value somewhere over $1 million or more. The guy was a total pirate, but he knew how to stay on the right side of the law. We dealt with him. I talked to him a bit about the phone. I always tried to prepare. I couldn't do it with the Brutons, but I tried to reach people before I met them face to face, so I would get a reading on them. And he was big in banking, too. I mean, the guy had money, and he stayed on top of everywhere it went. The ranch was really a hobby, and his son was a part-time pilot, would fly him in there. And he had flown him and his daughter, Penny. She made a nice lunch for us that day. We went up to the ranch. And nobody's doing any talking except the old man, though. And he's long dead now. I'm not sure I remember his name. Anyway, he was concerned about where we're going. He didn't mind the right of way going across the ranch because it very little effect on the ranching operation. However, he was in the process of developing North Lake for growing hay. That's the low spot, and I don't know if you've ever gone up there. It's a dry lake most of the time, but the water table's high in there, so he can pump wells and so on, and he put a lot of money into that. And I said, okay, well, I think we can stay out of that. I said that knowing we could, but I wanted him to feel like he was getting concession out of us, because that could be useful later on. So I'll get back to Charlottesville, we'll run it through the computer, see what happens, I'll let you know right away. So yeah, the arm is a few hundred feet shorter than it would have been otherwise. It stops right at the road up there. That's the kind of game you play with these people here. He was smart like the ranchers, but not like the ranchers, you know. He came at it more from the Jolly Roger and Black Flag aspect. Everything he touched turned to money. So we talked, actually it was rather interesting. His son was very quiet when he flew the airplane, left all the noise to the airplane, I think. His daughter, well, she didn't say much. You get the feeling she had quite an intellect. And, I don't know. It's just interesting to see how these people work, because I come from dirt farming, not gentleman farming. Somewhat different. Oh, gosh.
Well, let me ask you a question about that North Arm. There was another place I read that one reason the North Arm was shorter was because part of the end of the North Arm was irrigated.
That's what I'm talking about. That was North Lake. That's it.
Yep. And that the price exactly went up considerably, and that's why they decided to stay away from that.
To go in there and actually impact an operation that Matt had put a lot of money into, and he'd have fought it. It just wasn't worth it.
Right.
And it didn't significantly impact what the DLA could do. We were giving up a very small percentage of that thing.
Okay.
And, no, you've heard exactly the thing I'm talking about.
Okay.
The, oh, Buddy Major. I'm sorry.
His name was Taylor.
You're right.
I think.
You're exactly right. His name is Taylor. And to show how it went, I had some contacts and did some researching on him, found he's big in the Presbyterian Church in Texas, all this stuff, and learned a number of the things he was involved in. This information can be found if you know the right people. And when I talked to him on the phone before going out there, he was calling me Mr. Wade. Well, I learned he had been doing the same on me, because when we met there, he called me Dr. Wade. So I knew he'd been doing homework, too. But it's okay. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it, for heaven's sake. But I was amused. Well, talked to these people. But underlying all this trouble, I mentioned the lack of information. You've been to the Eagle Cafe in Battle. It was run by Lee Coker at that time. Lee was state senator in that area at the time, totally in the pocket of the ranchers. And so when this first went public, all these people go to Lee. This man's in government, you know. He knows what's going on. Well, he can stand up there and tell him he didn't know what was going on. So he handed out a bunch of plausible sounding stuff, which we had to undo later on. And later years wound up selling that place. And Santa Fe Diner down south, that's what he established and ran. Then his wife died, he died, and I think Coker's son and daughter-in-law now run the Eagle up there. It went on evil days a bit after he left because it went out of the family, and finally these people bought it back. But that's another thing. But this is the kind of thing we had to do, and it did not make our time any easier approaching people. Well, there's one more bit of history that is quite relevant here. Boss David King. King, of course, was looking at the politics of all this. He had lost control, the control he wanted of us, but he never got it. He called a public meeting. He was in the band room at the old high school in Magdalena. Ted Reif, who was then business manager from Inario, and I came out for that. Vic wasn't involved on that one. This was again in 72, probably May or June. Might have been a little later. Couldn't have been much different. Anyway, by then I had talked to everybody who we really were honor-bound to talk to on this. It was King's meeting. He had called in all the ranchers who were impacted anyway by this, and plus some others around, and that's fair enough, because we were going to change the nature of the area of Edna. Couldn't object to that. So what happens? Ted Reif and I show up there. A lot of people going around. Some we knew. Jack Bruton was there. Pleased to see you. Walked over and shook her hands. Mm-hmm. That was nice. And here comes David King in a big state government limousine driven by a state trooper, dressed in the kind of suit I have never owned. His shoes were shiny. Now, you go to Magdalena, how often do you see shiny shoes, you know, this sort of thing. Comes into the band room. Ted and I knew enough to dress like cowboys when we came out there, and I wore my oldest shoes, you know, and all that stuff. Here's King. He takes over. He said, you're going to have 10 minutes to tell people what this is about. To me. Okay. I had hoped to have a little more, and maybe be able to show some slides and so on, but that wasn't going to work, so I replanted things. Then he has his piece of paper, starts calling the roll. Jack Bruton, yeah, on down the line. I remember Mr. Taylor's foreman was there. Yeah. Montoya Cattle Company. That should be Montosha Cattle Company. Are you sure? God damn it, I'm sure. I worked for him 20 years. It was their foreman. And the people just laughed, and it was not a friendly laugh. In other words, David King was already becoming quite unpopular in the state.
You bet.
And so he goes through all that with this baleful look on his face, you know. The avenging angel has a little bit. All right, wait a minute, talk to him now. And so I went in there, tried to lay it out, and I felt they were being quite sympathetic. They were open-minded. They probably wished this hadn't come up, but These are basically honest people. I like them. At 5 minutes, King gets up and says, "All right, you talked long enough." I hadn't finished it. I couldn't fight it, so I said, "As you had it." That had a bad effect on the audience, too. We sat down, and we wound up talking privately with a lot of these people. King goes out and gets in the limousine and disappears again.
And that was it?
That was sort of it. That was his public meeting. And
no question and answer period, or
hadn't gotten to that, but we had it informally afterwards because
sure.
I stood around, and I think that these people could see we weren't man-eating tigers. Had to make the point over and over again: we were not from the government; we were from a contractor who was funded by the government. But the thing that resonated with me, we could be fired.
Yeah, that's right.
And this kind of thing, and so. I don't think we lost anything for that. I think David King lost. At that point, I had no thought that we'd be moving to New Mexico. But in 1980, Marianne and I, one of the people who stood in line 5 hours to do a write-in vote, led to Mr. Skeen taking office. But David King made himself hated everywhere.
Well,
that guy is awful.
To back up, because I don't know, I haven't been in New Mexico but for like the last 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, David King, he went on to be the representative that Joe Skeen finally took his place?
Here's the story. It was back, I think, about the beginning of 1980, Representative Congressman Runnels died. His son is still seen in politics, I think he's been prosecuting attorney in the next county north, things like that. But he was very popular. He was a Democrat, if I recall, but the Republicans usually didn't run a candidate against him. They found him very tolerable and would probably have gotten beaten if they had run one. So it's sort of like Governor Warren was in California. He had bipartisan support because everybody liked him,
mm-hmm.
and did a good job. And then he dies. And he died at a time when it was just too late under the rules for the Republicans to field a candidate against him. Bruce Keene stopped that, their efforts. They could have bet a few things here. I think David King already had the nomination from the Democratic thing, and Bruce wanted David to get to Congress. He's his nephew. Well, Bruce King did what he could successfully to block the Republicans from fielding a candidate against his nephew. Normally, this would have been a guarantee that his nephew gets to go to Congress. That offended people for some reason. And it offended a heck of a lot of Democrats, too, I might point out. We were both registered Democrats ourselves at that time. That changed with our recent ex-president. But anyway,
Skeen became a write-in.
There were two write-in candidates, Mrs. Runnels, for whom we voted, mm-hmm. and Joe Skeen. So here comes election day. People stand in line for hours, and we did, to vote for one of the other write-in candidates. David King came in third against two write-in candidates. Now that tells you something about how democracy can work.
Yes.
And he got smashed. And rightly so, darn it. And it was, I think, only the second time in U.S. history that a congressional candidate, an endorsed congressional candidate, had lost in the write-in. Other times in North Carolina or something, some years earlier. But I felt so good about that. Democracy can work. I do believe in democracy. But even if I deplore some of the practitioners, but anyway, we did our bit on that, and an awful lot of New Mexico citizens did the same, bless their hearts. And so Mr. Skeen got his 22 years in Congress. But I remember thinking at the time we were there in Magdalena, if I ever have a chance to vote against that son of a bitch, I won't miss it. And lo and behold, the opportunity came.
So now that meeting was in 72.
That was in 72.
At what point did you move here?
Well, that has to be put in the background of when people moved here. We got active on the ground late in 72, and there may be some anecdote there that is worth repeating. People began moving out here about 75 because there were things to do that. So there's a lot of work to get up and moving, get up to speed, these things. So you don't move people in immediately. For example, engineering work, the surveying, laying out the buildings, getting the buildings built, then we start moving people in. Some were hired locally, many more were in the design process in Charlottesville. Not the design group, these are the people who were actually designing the details. So that started in 75, and included Barry Clark, for example. The next year, I believe it was early 76, Jomies came out, and other people, Jack Lancaster. Have you met Jack Lancaster?
Not yet.
No, he's great. Because he actually is the chief of construction. Forrest Wells, who was the man who went out and got his feet muddy, too. And he died in 89. He came out at that time. And I came out in the end of 77. And come out with my first wife. And we decided, yeah, this is great. We want to do it. We bought the house that our first house here, which is in the north part of town, which we got rid of, and the kids are all gone because it's too big. And so we bought that house in the early part of October. Before the end of October, she was diagnosed with life-threatening leukemia. So here we were. We'd sold our house in Virginia then. It was all torn up. And she got enough of remission, moved her on out here. So in December, she died in May, fall. And so here I was, still with two junior high students at home. My daughter was married by then. She was a bit older. It was 3 years after we lost our son to leukemia, different forms. So I got tired of that disease. But it was a good change, I guess. But it was one thing that made me appreciate the plans of San Augustine. It's a very high stress time. I had to go up there, go up. And brought a lot of peace to the soul to realize how small you are, how small your problems are. Very healthy. And I'm sure I've survived without it, but it sure made it a lot easier. And so.
I've always said there's a crankiness warp just about this edge of Magdalena, because when I'm having a really wretched day in the office down here, I go out there and...
There's some sort of magic there, mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I felt it, and I'm grateful for it. And so anyway, it was a time of great stress. And the countryside helped to an extent. I think some of the contending sites would not have helped, and so it was. I ramble and ramble and ramble. I was going to mention, though, one thing. After we had things sort of going, we knew it was going to work. This is in November of 72. I brought Jack Lancaster and Forrest Wells out. They hadn't seen the site at that point.
Now, were they employed by NRAO at Green Bank doing things there?
They were hired in Charlottesville.
Okay.
Jack was hired because people at AUI knew him. He was based on Long Island and recommended him highly, and it was a good recommendation. Jack had known Forrest Wells, who had worked with him on a number of engineering-type jobs. He's basically a field supervisor. Mm-hmm. And Jack thought you could not do better than Forrest Wells, and I think he was right, Jack. Jack was very good. He was a hard-driving so-and-so, but that's what you needed. Forrest, more laid back, but he's the sort of guy who could get the most out of people without offending them. They were a good team. And, anyway, the...
They came out. They'd never seen them before.
That's right. They'd just been hired, you know, fairly recently. They were hired for construction. And we weren't moving on construction. Well, actually, they got directly involved things like what is called the joint venture. This involved some of the old Limbaugh group. Limbaugh had dissolved. And they're the people who did the actual layout of the sort of where you drive stakes in the ground on BLA. I'd driven the stake at the center, the first one. But then my gadget there and topo maps and cross checks of various sorts, I knew where I had marks. That was within a few feet, actually. You can do a lot with a thing like that if you go at it right. I think probably I was not off the final result more than 50 feet anywhere, 13 miles. But I'd done this sort of thing before. I had to show Jack and Forrest the layout of the situation. I knew where the arms were going. And they needed to get a good feeling for what it was like, feel what that dirt felt like, and they got in their shoes, you know, all that sort of stuff. You don't know the ground until you've done that. And so I went and showed them the stake I'd driven at the center, actually several years earlier. Jack Bruton didn't know about it, but it was his land. I walked out there and done it. And no harm done. We looked at the land as carefully as we could. We got an airplane, flew it, showed him all this stuff on the north arm that you mentioned. There's something else there that is relevant. I don't know how much time you got for this stuff. A lot of this is just coming back to me now. But a real trouble spot from the construction standpoint was at the extreme end of the west arm. A C-bar in ranch, which was Marvin Aikes. And there's a windmill there, which is right on the original line of the arm. That southwest arm hit one of Jack Bruton's windmills, and it hit this thing down here blocked from Marvin Aikes. So I sort of, on my own, moved the arm 1 degree. So it's not really all 120, but that took it a sufficient distance from the windmills. How many times did you hit two windmills with a lion? So that change was made, but we had to go down and look at that on the ground. It was very marshy. There was a lot of water that would stand there. I imagine the windmill was pumping some more water onto the ground. It was a place that needed to be looked at by people who are going to be building on it. It did take some special handling. So there we are. We parked the cars by the dirt road there and walked down toward it. Marvin Aikes' house is less than a mile away up on a rise there. Plain sight. I don't know if he was in it at the time or not. And I was walking next to Forrest as we went back there. And I said, Forrest, what you want to bet that Marvin Aikes got a telescope on us right now? And Forrest said, I hope there's not a rifle under it. And the feeling between my shoulder blades, I can remember to this day. But Forrest was like that. I mean, wonderful guy. He could say the right thing at the right time. Well, it's a privilege to work with people like that. So that was that west arm. The thing on the north arm, picked this up in the aerial photographs that Limbaugh had taken when they were doing the study that I mentioned earlier. I'd noted it, but never really looked at it. Big cracks in the ground. And we were warned when they were trying to scare us off from here about these cracks, these are earthquake cracks in the ground. Well, somewhere in there, I forget where it was, I mapped the things out from the aerial photographs and then went in there. There are these things, you know, this trench 6-8 feet deep. And cattle get in there and get along, or fall in, break a bone. What they were great mud cracks. Mm-hmm. The old lake bottom sediments are drying out. They're desiccation cracks, not earthquake cracks. And so what we did there, working with Forrest, we had the layout from the joint venture engineers and knew exactly where we wanted to go through. Then we staked the area and resurveyed those stakes at intervals. And we never, in the time I was involved in this, found any ground movement at all. So it must have finished. But it was a real worry, because at one place, I could see them on the aerial photographs, and you see them on the ground. Vehicle tracks. Hitting one of these tracks, one of these cracks, and then continuing on the other side. And they were the kind that an automobile would put down, or a truck. So it was in fairly recent time that crack had become open and active. So but it must have done its thing and then quit. The reason it wasn't deeper, of course, is the dirt would fall in from the sides. But I'm sure those cracks are there for our lifetime. But it was this kind of thing here. I was doing all that from Charlottesville at that time. This was before we moved out here. And actually, I don't think I'd moved out here except the area of Albemarle County where we were living. Are you familiar with Owensville? You go out Barracks Road,
yes,
about 5 miles,
yes,
toward Whitehall. Yeah, we had a place out there. It was starting to fill up with people. We weren't out there to be crowded with people.
Mm-hmm.
Said, with this, one thing leads to another, we decided to move out here, and then momentous developments, and so here we are. This carries it up to sort of my arrival here. I don't know how far, much farther you want to go.
You know what,
this.
I think let's stop right
there
for now.
I've probably exhausted you.
And
I've exhausted me.
Well, yeah. Yeah,
and it's amazing. So much of this stuff really hasn't been in front of my brain for many years. So I haven't had a chance to improve it.
Good.
But it's still not trustworthy. Please remember.
It's trustworthy as far as an oral history.
Yeah.
And that.